Zena.
And I'm Renee.
Welcome to When You Just Want a Glass of Wine, a podcast dedicated to making wine drinking more approachable and inclusive. Join us as we decode the language and unlock the customs of wine drinking. Cheers.
Cheers.
Okay, we're ready for this one? This
will be really absolutely fun.
Plus,
I'm excited about this.
We're going to Austria in more ways than one.
Exactly.
All right. Here we go.
Okay.
Welcome to this episode. It is a deep dive into Austrian wines. Cheers.
Cheers.
Cheers. Cheers to you, Klaus.
Cheers, Klaus.
Oh, we are so excited for this episode. This week we're heading to the Alps, but not for snowboarding yet, even though Klaus has promised me that I'm going to get a trip to the Alps where I'm going to snowboard. Can't wait for that.
I shall be in the lodge watching you drinking lovely wines.
But we are uncorking Austrian wines today. We're learning why this beautiful country is punching way above its weight in the wine world. And then next year, we are taking our Wine Game International, BSA Wine Club, and friends. We're going to do a trip to Vienna and Klaus's hometown of Salzburg for an unforgettable tasting adventure. So Klaus, our Austrian wine guru, and our favorite wine Sherpa, are going to be taking us there to eat some schnitzel, sip some Gruner, and go to actual Austrian vineyards. So get ready for this adventure of deep pours and deeper laughs and some serious wine. If you're interested, send us an email over at whenyoujustwantaglassofwine@gmail.com. We are also on When You Just Want a Glass of Wine on Instagram, and everywhere you get your podcast, you can be listening to us.
Spotify, Apple, join us. Join the conversation.
Join the conversation.
We're even on the book still.
Exactly.
The gram and the book.
So Klaus, let's get started with you. I'm so happy you are here. Thank you for joining us. Thank you for everything you've done for the past, I feel like we've known each other now almost since 2016, 2017. Thank you for taking me to Austria, starting my love of Austrian wines that I have here. So tell us a little bit about yourself.
Well, I never forget our dinner at the Stadtpark, Steirer Eck.
The number 9 restaurant in the world. That's going to be a side trip when we go back.
Yeah, better bring your big wallet with for that one.
Has that gone up? It wasn't that much. Remember, I think it was like 400 euro. I mean, which is a lot, but for what we got, it was insane.
It's an opera.
Yeah.
Just opera without music. It's opera with food and wine.
I love it.
Yeah, Austrian wine. This is my passion. This is what I've been doing for the last 25 years. My accent is Austrian. I grew up in Austria. I went to hotel management school because my German professor told my dad that your son is not going to be a doctor like you. So I loved cooking with my mom in the kitchen, and they decided that it would be good for me to go to a hotel management school in Salzburg, my hometown. And from there on, I traveled the world a little bit. I went to different restaurants and hotels in Austria when I was after the army, and somehow ended up in Bermuda.
Oh, nice.
And I had the opportunity to spend the summer in Bermuda and the winter in the ski resort in Austria. Mm. At 19, 20 years old, you know, life cannot be much better.
That sounds amazing.
And then I fell in love with this beautiful lady who I'm still married to 40 years later. I'm here in Virginia.
Wait, did you meet in Bermuda or did you meet in Germany?
Actually,
in Austria?
We did meet in Bermuda to a Michael Jackson song where I asked her to dance. And
oh my gosh, that's just too romantic.
And that was it. Yeah. And, you know, my family, my mother was very sad, but I just said, I'm going to leave. I'm going to America. I worked in restaurants for a while. I was a sommelier here in Great Falls, mostly French wines. For many years, I was there from 89 till 96, and then I decided to pursue Austrian wine because I didn't see a lot of Austrian wines in the United States.
No, there weren't.
So, yeah, and I called Terry Thies, who was the importer at that time of most of the good Austrian wines, or the few good Austrian wines he were able to find, and he kind of told me, you know, I only bring them in for myself because I like them, but I cannot afford anybody to bring on to sell those. There's not enough sales for that. And that's when I decided in the year 2000 to just do it on my own. And I created a little portfolio and I worked.
And we are all the better for it.
Yes, we are.
for sure.
Yeah, it's fun. It's delicious. And I always feel, you know, even so, Austria doesn't really have to export a lot of wines. And that's one of the main reasons you don't find that many Austrian wines, because number one, we are only 1% of the world's wine production with this tiny little country. If you want to put it in perspective, Maine and Austria is about the same size, but only 1/3 is planted with grapes, because the rest is mountains. And as we know, grapes don't do so well when you go to high altitude, yeah. Unless you have an ocean nearby, right. Then grapes can grow. But we are landlocked in Austria now.
That's right.
So. You have a question to get us started?
Well, let's talk about the geographic that we were just talking about, the different regions. So you're saying like it's only a small percentage of the country that's actually under vine, as they would say.
Undervine.
So why don't you talk about the four main wine regions? Because I believe there are four main regions.
Yes, most of the wines, like I mentioned, on the eastern side around Vienna. Mm-hmm. And then Vienna also is the number one wine destination place in Europe to go to, because within 1 hour, you can visit all the wine regions.
All the wine regions.
Versus when you go to Rome or to Paris, you have to travel quite a distance to get to the vineyards, to the wine regions.
And I love the fact that Vienna is actually its own, like AOC, so, it's its yes. own wine region.
And Vienna has history back and has its own wine region.
And you can stand in the vines and look down in downtown on the city.
Yeah, you can just take a little bus, or what do they call it, metro thing?
It's the trolley. It's the streetcar, the Straßenbahn. And you can take the N car from the middle of the town all the way out to Grinzing, which is the area where Beethoven wrote his Ninth Symphony. Uh-huh. And there's wonderful Heurigers and wine taverns where you can sip wine. And the vineyards are right there overlooking.
And they have a very unique, Vienna's a very unique wine region in Austria for what they make. We talked a little bit about that earlier, like, of how they make the wines, or the type of wines that are known for Vienna.
Yes, it's a little bit like you find in Chianti. Mm-hmm. And in Chianti, it's a field blend. And in Vienna, we call it gemischter Satz. So it's a mixed blend. And in former times, they didn't buy Grüner Veltliner or Riesling or Pinot Blanc at the nursery. They just bought a bunch of grapes, planted it in the vineyard, and that's how they grew. And then they harvested all together and make one wine out of it, and that's the traditional Viennese wine, and it's a DAC. And, you know, it's an okay wine, but it's not something
I used to get it when we were
blow
just,
you away.
Just sitting at the bar whenever I was, whatever, I would just grab a glass of it just to try it, because I knew we were tasting in wine regions.
It's a fun wine, it's something
easy
you drink.
Price, yeah.
But then you have, within Vienna, which is also in the area which is called Niederösterreich, so translating that, it would be Lower Austria, or if you want to, it's the Danube Valley. So it's the area which is more actually in the northern part of Austria. So
but lower because it's not in the mountains is what somebody was saying.
Lower it goes back to the Roman time, and the Danube was the border between the Romans and the Germans. And that was the lower part of the Danube. So that's why it's called Niederösterreich. Ostrich was the name. So in that area, we find most of the white wines, and Grüner Veltliner and Riesling is the two grapes which you find there most. And then when you go east of Vienna, you've come to the Burgenland region, which is on the Hungarian border. And that is actually the youngest area that was Austria became Austria after World War I. And that's most of the red wines. Even so, they make lots of delicious white wines, and actually it's the birthplace of Grüner Veltliner, because it originates from that area.
They have amazing sweet wines there as well.
And then, of course, we have the dessert wines because of the lake region, the Schneusiedlersee, it's called. And we always have botrytis, the natural mold, which around the vineyards close to the lake, because the water temperature in the fall is warmer than the air temperature. So you have fog every day, every year. We were able to make the trocken barren Auslese and the barren Auslese.
While you're taking us through the regions, what name a one or two wines or winemakers in each of those regions that people could look out for as you're describing them?
Well, in Niederösterreich, which is the largest wine region, you have the most famous area, which is the Wachau. So the Wachau Valley is Tegen Seerhof is one of my producers. And you have FX Bichler, Hertzberger, and you have all the big, big, big names from the Wachau. And this is just a little step above, because Wachau internationally is known because it's, number one, it's so beautiful.
Right.
And that's really, wines known around the world are always places you go to. Go to Tuscany, go to Napa Valley. And Wachau is kind of the same.
And had the river, has the river running
through. And of course, it's right on the Danube.
So pretty.
And then you have the Kremstal and the Kampdal, and we have Steininger in the Kampdal as my main producer. In the Kremstal, we have Preudel, and which is right behind the Wachau Valley, and then Kremstal actually goes on both sides of the river. You have the beautiful monastery, Stift Göttweig, overlooking everything. And then you have, I have Müller Grossmann, a lady winemaker who makes some delicious wines in the Kremstal. And if you go a little further towards Vienna, you come to the Wagram region, where we just had the Paul D. Paul D. is one of my...
I'm still having it.
I'm on the red.
Volume-wise, a big producer. He, you know, he makes great wines at a good price. And we have also Joseph Bauer, and my original partner who I started the company with for exporting, Anton Bauer, is also from the Wagram. And then you also, when you go further down, you have past Vienna, going towards Bratislava, you have Carnuntum, which actually belongs to Niederösterreich, but technically it's closer to Burgenland. So they're kind of fighting because everybody thinks of Niederösterreich, the white wine country, but they also do more reds there. And Zweigelt is really the home of that. And they have...
And that's Netzel.
Asina likes... Sina is a very much a Netzel fan.
Yes.
And Christina...
We love
of course, it was the Mama Netzel's goulash. I mean, how do you not, you know?
They're just... That's a wonderful family.
Yep.
So that's pretty much the Niederösterreich. There's one more area called Traisental, which is south of the Kremstal. But that's the area of Niederösterreich. And then you have a little further north, on the Czech border, you have the Weinviertel, which is kind of the central coast of Austria, where you get a lot of the sparkling wine, a lot of the grapes for the Morczak wines come from there, but also some good wineries there too. It's a little bit like central coast in California, you know. And then when you go to Burgenland, of course, Burgenland is kind of split in three areas. You got the northern part, like Neusiedlersee area, and the Leiterberg area, which is more the northern, right next to Carnuntum. And then you got the middle Burgenland, which is the more Blaufränkisch land. This is really where Blaufränkisch becomes like Bordeaux, very deep and dark. And then you have the Eisenberg, which is the southern part of Burgenland, where you got some great Welsh Rieslings and Pinot Blanc. And again, where Blaufränkisch becomes more Barolo-ish. And then we have another region in the southern part, which is called Steiermark. Styria. So the Steiermark is the area closer to the Mediterranean and also close to the Alps. And you will not find Riesling and you will not find Grüner there. The one grape they grow and they're most famous for is Sauvignon Blanc. So that's actually some of the greatest Sauvignon Blancs in the world are produced in Styria. Very steep hillsides, very green, it's very wet. So vintages do vary there quite a bit.
Is that where we get Joe Bauer's Sauvignon Blanc, or does he make it in?
No, Joe Bauer just worked with Strauss, which is my producer down there, and Bettina.
Strauss's,
So he did an internship down there, and Sauvignon Blanc, as we know, grows all over the world. It grows everywhere. So that's when he brought Sauvignon Blanc into the Wagram.
That makes sense.
And it's actually more consistent there because the weather is not as crazy as it's in Styria. So these are the four regions, Vienna, Niederösterreich, Burgenland, Steiermark. And then with climate change, there's one more, you brought it up earlier, Bergland. So we have another region, more the western part, where they also grow a few vineyards, but we will see. I mean, you know, like Canada starts growing wine, England starts growing wine.
Champagne,
sparkling.
It goes all over the world.
So with all the regions, what makes the terroir unique in those regions? Like, talk a little bit about the terroir, what it's like in the different regions.
Well, it's very different. Every region has, even the Niederösterreich area has different regions. And that's why Austria is also working very hard to separate itself from the German traditional Kabinett, Spätlese, Auslese, labeling the wines after ripeness. So we are very much working hard to follow the French, the AOC, appellation control, because as we know, you know, you sell wine for a while and you were in a restaurant. It's so much more important than when you do the tastings for the Psalms. I mean, you always go to the soil. The soil, the climate, and the soil can change. Even the climate is the same, but the soil can change. And that's also why Austria, I mean, we have a big book, The Austrian Wine in Depth, and that's like the first 20 pages talk all about the soil and the different areas. Because when the continents split 100 million years ago, Austria was smack center. So actually, you know, Asia, Africa, Europe, that's Austria was right there in that center and it split. So we have all these different
soil
types there, from really rock, gneiss, hard soil to this loess. So Riesling, you like to grow in rocks. Riesling grows where nothing else grows.
And let's talk, and while you're talking Riesling, we can't not talk about the fact that Rieslings in Austria are these, on the whole, beautiful, dry Rieslings. So when you hear Riesling in this conversation, we're not talking about the normal German-style sweet Riesling. We're talking, on the whole, these beautifully dry Rieslings.
Well, Germany is further north, so the Riesling grape grows where nothing else grows. So naturally, Germany needed to, in former times, to stop the fermentation a little bit earlier because the acids are just so high that you would not be able to really enjoy the Riesling. And that's why a lot of times you find German wines lower in alcohol, a little bit sweeter, because they leave a little residual sugar
to
balance out the acidity. Of course, climate is changing, and Germany is now making also some beautiful dry Rieslings. And I worked in L'Auberge Francois in a French restaurant, but it's in Alsace, and Alsace is kind of that part which switched between Germany and France a few times, but on the Vosges Mountains, they also make Riesling there, and it's actually very warm there, so they make, you know, Domaine Weinbach, Trembach, but they make dry Riesling. People always associate sugar in the grape with sweetness, and that's not always necessarily true.
Right. So, and I know that generally, other than the remarkable dessert wines, but generally Austrians drink dry wine. It's dry wine.
So most of the time we love dry wines. Right. We drink dry wines because of the climate, because we get the grapes ripe.
Yep.
And we also do have acidity, but not over the top. So we don't need as much sugar to balance out the acidity. Yeah. So we can make a bit more balanced wines at the 12-13% alcohol range, which is Burgundy, which is Loire Valley.
Right.
It's not in Italy. But I always like to call the Austrian producers stone fanatics when it comes to Riesling, because they love, like I mentioned, Riesling only grows where nothing else. So it's always the vineyards up on the top range where you have, because the winds, there's no more loess deposits. So it's pure gneiss, and the Riesling has to fight. And when the Riesling fights, the grapes are smaller. Mm-hmm. And of course they have more sugar, but the sugar turns into alcohol. But it also has beautiful flavors. So there's more minerality there. Very concentrated. And then you got that apricot peach, because around the valley and around the Wiesing vineyards usually have apricot and peach trees. So you get that flavor somehow in the Riesling as well. And it's, to me, I mean, I love Riesling, and I remember my times in L'Auberge, I recommended Riesling all the time, and people said, oh, what do you mean? You know, choucroute, garni, sausages, and sauerkraut. And I come and I'm the Psalm, and I go there. You ask me, right?
I can see it.
So I recommend Riesling, and you know, I always said, if you don't like it, don't worry, I'll drink it.
I'll drink it, exactly.
And I didn't have many Riesling bottles I had to drink, because almost everybody loved it.
That's too bad. One of the things that I am always interested in is the sustainability. And the different wine regions that are doing sustainable. And I know that Austria's got a big thing as well on sustainability, which kind of makes sense, because if you live in such a beautiful place, you want to take care of it and take care of the things.
Yeah, I mean, we have to understand Austria was smack center of World War II.
Right.
And also it was Russian territory after World War for a long time. And of course they have a different philosophy. So there was co-ops, there were grape growers, the farmers, and they drove up their tractors to the factory, basically what it's called.
Right.
And you got paid by the tonnage.
Right. Mm-hmm.
So that has long changed, and that's also why you find now Austrian wines with the little banderole on top with the flag.
Yeah, you'll have to tell
us. So all the Austrian wines have the red, white, red flag on top, because we really have the strictest wine laws in the world now. And we have to analyze, so every bottle gets analyzed and tasted by a blind tasting panel before it gets bottled as a quality wine. And then it gets this Prüfnummer, which is a number on the back label, and that also gets the what we call the banderole, that's the Austrian flag on top.
Which is red and white for everybody.
Red and white.
Red and white, it's easy flag. To pick out. It's the flag.
And I can always go into a wine cellar for a restaurant or somebody and say, you don't have enough Austrian wines, because you can see
clearly. I can see
clearly
it.
Yeah, I can see it from far away.
Well, we had to take the top off for Renee's tasting today, even though you kind of knew it was from Austria, but I didn't want to give it away right there. So. Yeah.
Well, she knew. She saw me as Austrian. But sustainability then, of course, comes in, because once we go into there, we don't have big corporations.
Right.
It's all family.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Passed down generation.
It's one of the best. It's one of the best parts about the wine.
So it's the greatest thing in my business now. I remember now when I started my business, all the kids used to be 2, 3, 4 years old now. They're actually in charge of the winery now.
Yep.
And I have some wineries, there's 4 generations working at the farm. So, of course, what do? You want to take care of your land.
Absolutely.
And you also take care of your workers. So to me, sustainability is much more than the organic. Organic is a lot of times just a buzzword.
Yeah,
it's just make it organic. Exactly. But sustainability is number one, because you take care of your environment, you take care of your employees, you take care of the water, you take care of so much more. Energy, which we all know, energy is
costly.
It's biggest thing
it is,
for the future.
Absolutely.
And sustainability takes all that in fact. So actually the Austrian Wine Marketing Board put out that almost all Austrian wines need to be sustainability. That is the most important thing where we go to. And you will find all my producers certified sustainable.
It's such an utterly unique wine region for that.
Didn't we notice that on the back when we did the reading the wine label with Andrew, and he was reading Steininger's label, and it said something about sustainability on it? He was surprised to see it. He hadn't noticed it before.
Austria sustainability.
He mentioned that in the sustainability.
Yeah.
Then vegan. Most of the wines are vegan.
Oh, which is
And now we have a new. Most of the wines will have also one of those QR codes nowadays, because the EU makes them to put that on there. So everything, I mean, I think they're in cahoot with the label printers. There must be some, because every year they have new rules and regulations.
Rules that comes up on it. So.
Well, let's talk a little bit about, let's pick a couple of the grapes that we were talking about, Zweigelt, Blaufränkisch. How would you explain those to kind of the average American listener today? Like, how do you describe those two grapes?
How do you describe them? Zweigelt is, when I compare to international grapes, I would take Zweigelt to the Merlot, and I would take Blaufränkisch to the Cabernet world drinkers. So that's kind of the two opposite, because in Bordeaux, you blend them together. But typically, the Cabernet is the more robust, the more bigger, the more full-bodied. And that's typically the Blaufränkisch. The only difference with the Blaufränkisch and the Cabernet, it has acidity, which Cabernet a lot of times doesn't have. So do you go more towards the Sangiovese or the Nebbiolo area? But Blaufränkisch, again, the soil determines much more what it will taste. Versus the Zweigelt, the Merlot, I would take it then also into the Gamay region. But of course, America has such an idea that Beaujolais is not good or Beaujolais is cheap, but actually Beaujolais,
it's lovely.
True Beaujolais, Gamay, is delicious. And that's what Zweigelt a lot of times goes to, with the more cherry and deep dark. When we tasted the Steindorfer, that color comes usually from Zweigelt. And many of our rosé wines are made from Zweigelt.
The rosé of Zweigelt,
because it gives the color very quickly, and then we can vinify it as a white.
We have the rosé of Zweigelt here, and it's absolutely delicious, the Müller. It's so bright.
And so the third big red that Austria is known for, and again, we talk about they plan a lot of different things, but would be the Saint Laurent.
That's not big; it's the smallest.
But it's the
original three grapes. And actually, Professor Zweigelt used the Blaufränkisch grape. He was commissioned by the Austrian government in 1920, and in 1922, he crossed the Blaufränkisch with the Saint Laurent, because Blaufränkisch doesn't get ripe in all the regions because right. it's a more late budding, late ripening grape.
It's a late ripening.
So it needs more like the Burgenland area where you find most of the Blaufränkisch, which is actually very hot there. Versus the other regions around the Danube, by that time when they get ripe, it gets fairly cold in October, November.
Right.
So that's when he crossed and used the St. Laurent grape, which is in the Pinot Noir family. So it's a fairly early ripening grape.
And it's difficult to grow like Pinot Noir as well.
It's difficult. It's very affected. It's disease, the skin. And it goes only to a certain, for climate change now, St. Laurent might become, because it only ripens to a certain level and then it stops producing sugar. Right. It just stops. The only thing is you have to be very careful. You have to find that day because once you go past, it's
that
awful.
Day. It's that day.
You have to find.
Yeah. Right.
And, yeah. you know, that's.
But I like that story because it was an intentional grafting, an intentional combining of the varietals as opposed yeah. to
and then
the spontaneous mutation.
No, it's potential. Like and then yeah. they created the Zweigelt. There was many other grapes developed.
And is Zweigelt the most consumed
red? It's the most planted red most grape. Planted. It's about 14% of the vineyards in Austria at Zweigelt because everybody wants to have a little red too. So every okay. winery will put some Zweigelt wines. We actually, unfortunately, the EU gave a little bit too much money out to plant red wines, red grapes, and the Austrians, 95% what they consume is white.
Is white. So let's talk
white
about
wine
that.
Drinker.
Yeah, let's talk about the primary, the big grape that everybody knows Austria for, if they know Austria at all, is Grüner Veltliner. So let's talk a little bit about that and a comparison. If you've never had Grüner, what would be similar?
Yeah, I mean, of course, the regions and price point will give away a lot.
Right.
So the most, what we drink in Austria, the Grüner Veltliner, is the more lighter, easier style Grüner Veltliner. And I like to compare it. It's something in the Sauvignon Blanc, Pinot Grigio. I don't like to bring in Riesling because of Riesling people associate mm-hmm. with sweet, but it has that little brightness. And it has always green apple. So that's always a little Grüner Veltliner, grün. And the grape originates actually in northern Italy. And Tramin, Sauvignon is the mother grape of many, many grapes. And it was brought to Burgenland, and there was a wild crossing. And then the only reason why we planted so much Grüner in Austria is because it's a very vigorous, easy variety.
Yes.
And it grows and it loves loose. It loves that. And that area around Vienna, east of the Alps,
right.
where all the loess was deposited. So especially right. Kremstal and Kampdal and Triesen. And Grüner Veltliner just grows.
Explain a loess just a little bit so people can understand it.
So it's in the ice time, we had very high winds. So fine crystals from the Alps was blown eastwards. And you actually find loess in Missouri as well.
Yeah.
From the Rocky Mountains, you find the same.
It's why we grow various things that we grow, which are very German-style wines yeah. in Missouri.
So, and that was then deposited, and it looks like sand. It looks very much like sand, but it could get a little harder. But the animals, the fly, the bees, the little birds, they can live in there, and the vines can easily grow deep down till they find water. It also reflects a lot of warmness. So that's why Grüner Veltliner grown in loess becomes a little bit more tropical.
Yeah,
you get a bit more of
yeah.
the pineapple, mango, the tropical fruit.
Mm-hmm.
But it also minerality because if the water has to go down and the water come in the grapes, the juice has to come back up. So you get a lot of the minerality. Mm-hmm. And then it appears to be like white pepper.
Pfeffer. Yeah, I always
call it
white
pfeffer. Pepper. There's always white pepper on Grüner Veltliner. And so it's not as aggressive as Sauvignon Blanc, so you don't get the grapefruit citrus, but you get a touch of lime, a little bit lemon, lime,
mm-hmm.
and green apple. And I always like to refer to Grüner Veltliner a little bit like Chardonnay, because Chardonnay, you know, a lot of people say, I don't like Chardonnay.
Yeah, we don't believe in
and
that.
And then you put them a Chassin Montrachet or a Pouligny Montrachet.
Or a champagne.
And it's like, oh, this is the best wine in the world.
Right.
And then you say, oh, but this is made from Chardonnay, because they are just used to the grocery store.
Right.
Butter, you know, I put butter on my bread. I don't want butter in my wine. I don't need the butter oaky.
See, this is why Klaus and I are right here. I'm like, I'm the same.
But In Burgundy, you have Macon Village, you have Puy
Frise. Which Fisse. I don't care for, as we decided.
Yeah, but you do like Puy Frise.
So Puy Frise is a little bit more richer.
Yeah.
Saint-Véran. And then you got, of course, the real Chablis. And then the villages, Chassan, Poligny, Montrachet, and the Le Montrachet.
No, I love
everything
Chardonnay.
Is made like Chardonnay. Everything is made, the white grape in Burgundy is Chardonnay.
Yeah.
But it all tastes different.
It's reflective of the climate, it's reflective of the soil.
And that's very much what Grüner Veltliner is. But most consumed Grüner Veltliner is the more entry-level, easy, lighter alcohol. And you can just drink.
Drink it all day long.
Sometimes what you have to be careful is that one bottle is barely enough for one person.
I know. You could drink it all day long.
This is why I have it as a by the glass. So I remember when I first created the list, somebody said, why do you have Grüner? I didn't have Chardonnay. I had a Grüner. Why do you have Grüner on the list? And then somebody was standing by and said, I love a Grüner by the glass. It's such a great by the glass wine because it's a reasonable price and it gives you a lot.
I like it.
It's our number one selling of everything we sell in the entire shop. The number one selling item is the Grüner.
And it makes you hungry. It makes you want to eat.
Oh, that makes you want to eat. I like Grüner in a glass. I like Grüner in a bottle. I like Grüner in a can.
You do it at all.
Had before, like, you know, and it'll do.
What are you eating with a Grüner?
So cold cuts is kind of, you know, cheese and cold cuts, charcuterie boards. That's the one. Traditionally, Wiener Schnitzel. So anything fried, fried chicken.
It's got that champagne quality to that, you know, that kind of thing.
Got champagne, same thing, fried chicken.
White asparagus.
Calamari. And then, of course,
vegetables.
Vegetarians.
Yeah, love
they,
it.
They, Grüner Veltliner is, there's so many, artichoke, hardly, very difficult to pair. A Grüner can work. And of course,
and asparagus also asparagus, very difficult to pair.
You know, we don't do as much asparagus here in America, but like if you go to Germany or Austria in May, that's all you get. That's all you see.
White asparagus.
Is asparagus.
What are you eating? What are you food pairing with a Blaufränkisches Zweigelt, the Saint Laurent? What's surprising? Like, what's a really kind of cool pairing that you might not think about?
Well, Blaufränkisch is, of course, game. So we love game dishes like venison and then, of course, duck sometimes goes quite with it, quite well as well. Zweigelt is more your pizza wine. It's kind of, you know, when you have high acid.
I love that. Jimmy's going to love that idea. Zweigelt with pizza wine.
Pizza, pasta, anything tomato sauce, tomato-based. Mm-hmm. Zweigelt works just like the Italian reds work so well with their food because they have acidity. And that's what Zweigelt is, and there's no tannins. So it's easy, it's chillable, and it's light to drink. And then St. Laurent goes more into the Pinot Noir direction again. So actually, I like duck, I mentioned before, but I like duck with St. Laurent very much. Mm.
You know what I was going to ask a question about? It was what we were talking when we did your What's in Renee's Glass. I'd love to talk a little bit about the aging, because you mentioned the cement. And I remember visiting and seeing that and how the aging more, you know, are they using
fermentation?
Are they using stainless steel, using oak? Are they using these big cements? What's going on?
Well, traditionally, you always used oak barrels, larger oak barrels, futons, and, you know, white or red are made there. And then, of course, stainless steel came, and stainless steel is really what brings the fruit to the front. So any kind of white wine or even red wines are fermented in stainless steel too. It's neutral. So it preserves the flavor of the grape. And most of the wines, I would say 60, 70% of the wines are consumed fairly early. We actually in Austria...
43 minutes.
We don't...
And I always say, you know, like us in the wine business, we are the worst people because, you know, it takes a whole year to grow grapes and it takes actually years for the vineyards to become. And then we go and we pop the cork or unscrew it, put it in the glass, and within 2 seconds or 3 seconds, we make a decision. And it's just horrible. It's just, and I am way on top of this terrible thing. But wine needs to... Time, good time, longer time, the more you pay.
Right.
And the better, usually, most of the time it also becomes, because good wine takes time. So easy wine, I always put it in a price point. So when you pay up to $20, $25, drink it. When you buy it, go home, put it in the fridge, drink it. No reason to hold on to it until next year, because next vintage, most of the time, will be better. When it first comes, because that is the type of wine you want the fruit forward. You want to taste it in the front, fresh. You want the the citrus flavors. You want the freshness. Then when you pay a little bit more, and then you want creaminess. You want richness. You want the mouth to be full. So that's the wines which we usually vinify slower with the contact of the skin. Usually used in barrels, sometimes neutral. Not too many times new oak. We don't like too much new oak in Austria because the flavor of the grapes are already flavorful, so we don't need to add lots of flavors. And then, you know, we find concrete is neutral, but it lets air in it.
Right.
So it's not like stainless steel, which is just neutral. That lets the wine age a little bit more, or is it being in contact with air, which then when you get it in your glass, it's much fuller. The color becomes
like different.
When you first started looking at the wine, first thing is always color.
The colors, yeah.
So, yeah. And then we have some other, I always forget what it's called, but they look a little bit like capsules. And there's other kind of little things they're starting to do in Italy. Then we have amphora, like they used to make.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Long time ago.
Georgian wines.
You bury it in the earth and let, you know, the earth.
All just, the things.
But then you have no control. Then you just.
It's harder, yeah. It's more of a risky. It's a bit of a poker match. I also like that you have, because a general misconception for people that are new to wine is that you age red wines and you don't age white wines. But there are some Rieslings, Austrian Rieslings and things, and even some of the higher end that you can lay down for a bit.
Those Wachau
and age
Rieslings,
them
right?
And they're.
Yeah, Riesling, Wachau, Kremstal. I mean, good Riesling.
Good Riesling,
You gotta pay $40-50 for it if you wanna lay it down.
Yeah, a special one.
But they have acidity and they have sugar. So when you have those components, or like red wines, you need oak,
right?
Tannins. But again, you need fruit. Sure, you need very ripe grapes.
Yeah.
And Riesling is one of those varieties which we harvest the latest. So usually Riesling usually comes in when everything else is in the cellar. Riesling is still out there. The leaves come down and then they take in the sun. And then the Riesling has that higher sugar level and the high acid because it gets very cool nights. So, and it doesn't go to, and then when you make a good wine out of it, even if it's stainless steel, it can age.
It can age, yeah.
For a long time, even if it's a screw cap.
Yeah.
Don't worry about that.
You don't even have to lay it down.
Nope.
Well, if somebody said to you, let's take Gruner to the side, because we all know that that's kind of the grape of Austria. But besides Gruner, if somebody said to you, I don't like white wine, what white would you suggest to them? Austrian.
Weißburgunder.
Okay.
That's one. Weißburgunder. It's the Pinot Blanc. It's the Chardonnay, which you don't really know, and the French will never admit that Meursault, that there is some Weißburgunder Pinot Blanc in Burgundy as well. But it's the more nutty. It has more flavor. And it has a brightness, and I love Weißburgunder.
Mm, that's a good thing. I think we can't get away from Austrian wines without talking about your beautiful dessert wines.
Nice point.
Because I think a lot of people, another misconception is, if I don't like sweet wines, I don't like dessert wines. You're like, you haven't had the right one. For instance, you know, let's talk about yours.
The Klaus Cuvée.
The Cuvée Klaus.
That's kind of... the Steindorfer from Burgenland, which is the Lake Neusiedlersee. And there we have that natural appearance of the botrytis, which is basically just mold. We just have a fancy word for it, botrytis cinerea.
You'll hear it often, the noble rot.
The noble rot. And there's actually three regions in the world. The most famous one is the Sauternes, the Chateau Yquem on top. And then you have the Tokaj region in Hungary. And then you have, of course, the Lake Neusiedlersee. And there, the botrytis happens every year because the lake is very shallow. So the water temperature is always warmer than the air temperature when it comes to the fall, when the grapes get ripe. And then you have to start fighting with the birds because the birds also know the really sweet grapes. They can eat one of those vineyards in 10 seconds. I mean, they can land and within 1 minute, it's wiped out. So that's why many of them are covered with nets.
Right.
So we have to, but the birds found out a way how to get underneath
the
nets.
They get in.
So we actually shoot in the air every so often. We have these little, and then we have these little windmills and I mean, trying to get some noise so they don't land. But the Botrytis, these wines, I mean, they're sweet, yes, they're dessert wines. But the great thing, they have acidity. So there's a balance. And the Cuvée
it's
Klaus...
It's not that cloying...
No, it's not cloyingly
it's like
sweet.
Liquid honey, liquid gold.
We usually like to blend a variety which is more like Chardonnay or Pinot Blanc or creamier with a other variety which is high acid, like Welsh Riesling or Scheurebe, which is in the Riesling family. But when you blend those two, you get both worlds. You get that creamy, rich mouthfeel, but you also get that bright acidity and freshness. And they usually have like that peach, apricot, and honey.
I love that apricot in it.
I saw someone pair it with oysters because it was the sweet and the salt. They're like, it was a perfect shellfish pairing. And the person that was tasting was like, I don't know about that. And then he was like, oh my God, that's amazing.
I didn't say no to that.
Yeah.
Well, what are you drinking at home when you just want a glass of wine?
Most of the time, it's Grüner Veltliner. Mm-hmm. When I really want to open a bottle of wine, it will be a Riesling.
Ah, I love to hear that.
I love Riesling. And I can pair it with so much food. I can go with a lot of things. When it comes to red, you know, I am a big Blaufränkisch person, but it's a bit more difficult. And then we also make some wonderful blends. And I'm more... like Bordeaux, like this Appetlan Rouge we had today, and like Netzel makes the Anna Christina.
I like the Anna
Christina. More, I feel sometimes when you put two or three components together, especially in red wine, like Leo Hillinger makes the Hill One, and that's how he actually got famous in Austria with that wine, and that's Merlot dominated, but it has
the
Austrian.
That explains why I liked it so much.
So yeah,
it's a good one. We brought that in when he was here.
Yeah, and it's just amazing. So I when I go to red a lot of times, but then of course Pinot Noir, don't count me out on Pinots.
I was gonna say, like, what non-Austrian wine would be your go-to? Do you have a favorite wine region outside of Austria?
The Rhone Valley.
The Rhone Valley.
Would go definitely into the Rhone Valley. That's one of
Klaus
my.
Klaus and I have very similar.
You do. I see that. I heard. I did see a wonderful quote. It said, "If Pinot Noir went on a moody ski trip to the Alps, it might come back as a Saint-Laurent."
Yeah.
I thought that was a great because I want to do my moody snowboarding trip. Renee, do you have any more questions for Klaus?
No.
You think Klaus? Do you have anything special to tell us about Austrian wines? You feel we covered
anything
everything?
Anything sparkling? We didn't talk about sparkling, I guess.
Oh, the Steininger sparklings.
You missed that, and I missed it too. But they are a wonderful family, and we call it sect in Austria.
Yes.
And that's sparkling wine, and they just have a. We have to do another episode with them. Steininger thing.
Because you know how much I love that.
Because that's just amazing. And they have a wine spa right on the property. Yeah. And you can experience everything. But all I can say is drink more Austrian wines. But don't worry. The 9 million people in Austria, we produce about 250 million liters. And we drink 250 million liters in Austria.
That was one of my favorite quotes from my research last night where they're like, they really don't need us. Like they want to sell some out, but it's like it's a great wine culture.
Yes,
and it's great food culture. It's just
Vienna,
great.
People think always Austria is the beer country because Munich and Salzburg is more beer. But when you come to Vienna, Vienna is really wine culture. It's food, wine, music.
Do you have all these things planned for our trip for next year?
It's out of the bag. I have to start working on it.
You do have to start working on it. We're going to start in Vienna, and we're going to end in Salzburg, remember?
Trying to get Sina off my back for years now, but now it's out. I have to really do it.
And then we are definitely going by Jimmy and I, and anyone else who wants to join. We are definitely snowboarding. Over by Salzburg. That is on the top of our list because you could actually snowboard over in Salzburg for almost definitely cheaper than you can get out to Colorado. So I'm all in for a snowboarding Saint-Laurent or something.
My knees are going to be sitting in a lovely wine bar somewhere or at a vineyard drinking
wine. Well, the après-ski is actually much better. Even better. I mean, that's the après ski. There's no Burger Kings or McDonald's in any of those ski lodges. There's real food.
I'll go there.
They actually have wine. They have wine lists.
Wine and schnitzel. I am in. Well, Klaus, thank you so much for joining us today for the two What's in Renee's glasses. And of course,
thank you for
that.
Thank you for your time.
Cheers.
They drank it all. There's nothing in their glasses.
There's nothing left. But there's a little bit in mine.
Cheers to both of you.
Prost.
Thank you. Prost.
Woo.
That's great.
That was delicious.
Love it.